probability theory arising from them,
probability distribution over randomly bifurcating trees. And in the course of that, I actually learnt a lot from Anthony. And in passing, he also taught me how to fly a glider, which was also interesting. It is characteristic of Anthony that he has very wide range of interests and types of interest, ranging from the analytical to the historical. And I'm quite sure that a lot of this will emerge in the course of his talk about R.A. Fisher. So, Anthony, over to you.
Well, good evening. It's 54 years now since R.A. Fisher died. He died in 1962, and in 2012, the Was Statistical Society held a commemorative meeting, and I was asked to give some reminiscences, which I very happily did. Fortunately, I wrote them down afterwards. And so, when I've been asked to reminisce about Fisher again, I've had a ready script. Now, I don't apologise for this, because it means that particular incidents are correctly, so far as my memory tells me, recorded on paper. So this is an illustrated talk by all means, but it also does come with a script. However, it's not been published. I have given it two or three times in various places. I have no plans to publish it, but it does contain detailed information which I'm happy to place on record. And it will take a sufficiently short time that then we can have some discussion if you want to ask questions about Fisher, and if you want to get me to reminisce about things that I'd rather not put on paper, then that would be the occasion on which you can do it. We have on the screen a nice picture of Fisher from the Fellows Photograph Album in Godwin and Keyes College. To have studied the works of R.A. Fisher, as a matter of fact, if I have remembered, I have a pair of glasses which makes it a little bit easier for me to read both the script and to look at you. Two things which are necessary for any lecturer. To have studied the works of R.A. Fisher intensively is to know him better than to have passed brief periods in his company. Moreover, it has never been easier to do so, since his collected papers and important books are available on the internet, as well as much of his correspondence. Substantial commentaries help the scholar to follow his dense and intricate arguments, and later developments emphasize the breadth and originality of his work. Personal reminiscences can add little to the understanding of so great a scientist, but to those of us lucky enough to possess them, there is something to be said for recording them for the benefit, or at least for the pleasure, of our friends and descendants, while historians of science urge us to do so just in case they illuminate the workings of a mind of such incomparable brilliance. Indeed, my own introduction to Fisher was through one of his books, Statistical Methods for Research Workers. 18 years old, I had stayed on an extra term at school to take the scholarship exam at the Cambridge College, Trinity Hall, as a matter of fact. This had left me the first 9 months of 1954 free before going up to Cambridge to read natural sciences. And as an enthusiastic schoolboy astronomer, I simply wrote to the Astronomer Royal, Sir Harold Spencer Jones, to ask if I might spend 6 months working at the Royal Greenwich Observatory, which was then the Hurstmans and Castle in Sussex. I expect I mentioned that I was interested in the analysis of data, for in agreeing to my proposal, he assigned me to the solar department, where I was to assist in the reduction of sunspot data from the daily photographic images, most of which were taken in India. This was done by assistants using algorithms enshrined in specially designed forms, together with the use of tables and logarithms. I was the computer, and my colleagues, and the forms were the programs. Part of the output was the ratio of the umbral to penumbral area of each regular sunspot. And in the evenings, after work, I started to plot this ratio year by year, and soon discovered that it varied according to the 11-year solar cycle. This was disputed by the head of the department, on the grounds that if it were true, someone would have discovered it before. But he was near retirement, and his appointed successor, Patrick Wayman, was already in post as his deputy. Patrick was horrified and introduced me to the notion of a significance test by lending me statistical methods for research workers. With his support, I wrote my first scientific paper. But it had to wait until the retirement of the long-serving head of the department in 1957 before it could be published, when one of Patrick's first acts was to write to me in Trinity Hall and ask me whether I still possessed the manuscript, which I did, so he had it typed up and it was published. Thus, by the time I was an undergraduate in Trinity Hall, I knew about statistical methods by R.A. Fisher. I did not know that he was still alive as professor of genetics and a fellow of the neighbouring college, Goblin of Keys. To describe my subsequent interaction with him will inevitably be in part autobiographical, but I shall try to limit myself to such background as is necessary. And here I'm going to tell you what you all know already, but I won't leave it out. The Cambridge Natural Sciences Tripods has a part one with a large list of subjects from which one must choose a prescribed number, or at least it did in those days, followed by a one-year single subject, part two. My part one was physics, with a clutch of allied subjects, but I found the mathematics too difficult and the rest rather boring. As a result, in mathematics I was downgraded to the half subject and had to find another subject in view. I opted for history and philosophy of science, but I soon gave up the philosophy lectures because though they were on induction, they seemed ignorant of statistical inference. And I had read statistical methods and I thought I knew better. I'd only been placed in the third class at the end of my first year, and my plan had not been to take a scientific part two, but to do part one of the mathematical tripods, which I thought I could cope with, and which would get me an honours degree and enable me to think of a career in teaching. However, someone, I forget whom, but I now think it was probably my brother John, told me that to do part one natural sciences, and not a part two, would be a waste of Cambridge, and that I should look at the part two options. I bought a copy of the complete lecture list, no longer possible of course, and I studied the possibilities. One was genetics. I glanced at the titles of the lectures and the names of the lecturers. To my astonishment, one of the latter was Sir Ronald Fisher. I put two and two together, so he was still alive. And, as I soon discovered, not Professor of Statistics, but Arthur Balfour Professor of Genetics. There was a note on the lecture list which read, "Students who may wish to read Part 2 Genetics in the following academic year should see Dr. Owen or Dr. Wallace sometime before the division of the term." The first half of the Easter term was not yet over, so I jumped on my bicycle and set off for the department, housed in what had originally been the Arthur Balfour Professor's private house, his designated residence at 44 Storey Square. The front door was open, and so was the door of the room immediately across the hall, where sat a small bearded man with thick glasses. He asked me whom I was looking for, and clutching my lecture list, I replied, "Dr. Owen or Dr. Wallace." On hearing my reason for asking, he said that he was Professor Fisher, and would be glad to discuss the possibility of my taking part in genetics himself. He invited me out into the garden, and for a couple of hours we walked up and down the grass paths between the experimental plots of primroses and purple loosestrife, of garden peas grown to demonstrate Mendelian segregation, and strawberry beds. I said very little, but had to be alert as to which way Fisher was going to turn at the end of each path. What he said was totally fascinating, though I have no recollection of it. I probably didn't understand a word of it. He ended by saying that I should come back the following afternoon to continue the conversation. I eagerly returned as instructed, and after some further discussion he said he was prepared to take me as a student for the next academic year. As I did not have a biological background, I should come up to the department for a week during the long vacation term to look at the flowers, as he put it. There are several remarkable aspects to this decision. One is that the only examination for my name was the third in my first year, so I was hardly promising material. Another is that I had not consulted my tutor, or director of studies, or anyone else, but had acted on my own initiative, just as when I had written to the Astronomer Royal. Had I tried the orthodox route, I would have found that genetics was regarded as a very dubious subject, considered to be trespassing on the preserves of the departments of botany and zoology, headed by a rather eccentric man called Fisher, with a sharp temper, who would in any case no doubt be winding down in his retirement year. That I was the single student Fisher admitted to his Part II course during his last year can only be attributed to the fact that no one responsible for advising students in any college of the university had recommended it, and I simply bypassed the regular system. When my admirable Trinity Hall tutor, the historian Charles Crawley, heard of my plan, I fear he may, after consulting his scientific colleagues, have felt it his duty to query Fisher's invitation to me. For I later heard that Fisher called to see him in his room and had berated him for what he had done. Of this I knew nothing at the time. My father, Harold Edwards, who was also concerned about my choice, and he wrote to Fisher, whose reply, dated the 26th of June 1956, is a model of how a university teacher should reply to an anxious parent. In due course, the two men were to meet, and Father entertained Fisher in London. I should like to add that the reason I now think it was my older brother John who advised me to do a part two is that during his own Cambridge career as a medical student, he spent 3 years over part one, but never progressed beyond the third in any examination. He regretted having missed the opportunity to study a part two subject. Even so, he was to become a fellow of the Royal Society and professor of genetics at Oxford, the co-discoverer of Edwards' syndrome, which is trisomy 18. When the summer came, I duly turned up for my week in the department. "Who are you?" asked Fisher. I replied that he had told me to come and look at the flowers. He pulled a large buff offprint from his desk drawer and said that I should study it, and when I had understood it, come back for something more. It was called... The Theory of Linkage in Polysomic Inheritance. Am I in your way? I'm moving away over here, perhaps. The Theory of Linkage in Polysomic Inheritance from the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society of London. I'm going to pass it round. It's the very copy. In retrospect, I think he knew perfectly well what he was doing. Started in October. I describe in some of my other reminiscences some of the features of the department and its members then. The formal lectures, as listed in the lecture list, took place in the centre of Cambridge in the Agriculture Building, later to house, as it happens, the present Department of Genetics. The convention was that the whole department attended, even sometimes the other lecturers and Fisher himself. This often led to quite amusing situations. Dr. R.C. Campbell, Colin Campbell, some of you will remember, was invited to give a course entitled Animal Improvement. He used as his text Mather's book Biometrical Genetics, from which he often appeared to be reading. Mather, who had worked with Fisher before the war, had learned his biometrical genetics from Fisher, adding some developments of his own. The circle was completed by Fisher sitting in the front row taking notes. Fisher gave introductory lectures entitled Basis of Genetics at 5 in the afternoon of the Michaelmas term, presumably intended for those thinking of reading Part 2 in the following year, and thus very suitable for me. After the lecture, he and a few students often repaired to the nearby pub called the Bun Shop. Anybody remember the Bun Shop? Oh, very good. Round about the back entrance of John Lewis, in the old Lion Yard. Already famous at the site of his expounding of his theory of the genetics of the rhesus blood group rockers to R.R. Race in 1943 and in 1944. In the Part 2 course itself, Fisher lectured on linkage, theory of recombination. And after the first couple of lectures or so, I went up to him and I said, I'm sorry, I don't really know very much statistics. Well, he said, stroking his beard, I've written one or two books on statistics that you could try. I went immediately to Heather's and I bought Statistical Methods for Research Workers, The Design of Experiments, and Statistical Methods and Scientific Inference, all very reasonably priced. When I graduated, I asked him to sign them, which he gladly did, together with my copy of his statistical tables. Many years later, when I got to know Frank Yates, his co-author for Statistical Tables, I asked for his signature too, and I shortly possessed the only copy of Statistical Tables signed by both the authors. In the Lent term, his lectures were on polysomic inheritance and involved an immediate dive into the mathematical theory of partitions, as I had already discovered from my exposure to his Philosophical Transactions paper. I took Fisher's lectures very seriously, making careful notes which I later transcribed into a fair copy with the convention that nothing went into it which I'd not understood. I pestered the research students for explanations of difficult points. As a result, I own a very presentable record of Fisher's lecture course for the benefit of historians. He started each lecture with a determined attempt to be comprehensible to our students. But before long, he would cease to be aware of our existence and would follow his own thoughts unfettered. When adding up a column of figures on the blackboard, he would sometimes proceed from left to right, somehow organising the carries in his head. As he finished his very last lecture of that year, I thought, this is a historic moment. He has been a professor at University College London and here in Cambridge for 35 years, and it is the end of his formal lecturing. I don't think anyone else present shared that thought, except perhaps Fisher himself. Meanwhile, I started again with statistical methods and became very interested in Fisher's comments of Geissler's data on the human sex ratio, which he used as an example of the binomial distribution. I soon invented the two-parameter beta binomial distribution for myself as a means of accommodating variation in the binomial parameter between families, and thought I could fit it by equating its mean and variance to the sample mean and variance. I need two equations, so why not? Anxious research students warned me that this was called Pearson's method of bones and was not to be indulged in when Fisher was around. But it seemed sensible to me, so I carried on using it, working with the mechanical calculating machine in the library, the only one in the department. One afternoon Fisher came in and asked me what I was doing. I showed him nervously. He told me off so half-heartedly for not concentrating instead on my tripod studies, but I'm sure in reality he was glad to see a student doing something on his own initiative. You also told me to look up Corrado Gini's book, Il sesso dal punto di vista statistico, 1908, in the library. I did so immediately, found it to be signed by him and dated August 4th, 1925. Probably Gini had presented it to him. I subsequently learned that it was still available and bought my own copy, dated April 9th, 1959, when I received it. Sometimes when Fisher came past in the library, I would ask for an explanation of the point in the lectures, and I kept the little notes he made in reply, for example. One amusing consequence of an interest in Geissler's data was that I noticed that Fisher's reference to it in the 12th edition of Statistical Methods for Research Workers omitted Geissler's initial A for Arthur. So I advised him on it, and the correction stands in the 13th, last edition, of my contribution to it. As the academic year went by, I took to my new subject like a duck to water. The biology was not too difficult, and the mathematics was in my compass. Dr. Owen lectured on the more mathematical side, and Dr. Wallace involved us in the practical work with mice for which she was responsible. Every weekday, we students would meet in Fisher's study, the room where I first met him, for tea, and the conversation was always as lively as it was serious. Of course, nothing could put off the approaching TRIPOS examination. I practiced hard with the past papers, and did not hesitate to ask Fisher directly about points that still puzzled me. I soon realised that when he passed my question on to one of the research students, it probably meant that it was not uppermost in his mind, and would therefore not be one of the examination questions. I also knew by then that it was very poor eyesight, so I bought a fountain pen with the widest possible nib, together with a bottle of jet black ink, and practised painting my mathematical answers with it. Came the examination and I had little difficulty. David Jones, who had been admitted the previous year and was taking 2 years over Part 2, and I were both placed in the first class. Fisher was delighted, but George Owen was puzzled and would say no more than, "You weren't supposed to get a first." It turned out that at the very time Fisher was one of my examiners in Cambridge, my father, Harold Edwards, was one of the examiners in surgery at Trinity College, Dublin, where Rose, one of Fisher's daughters, was taking her exams. But fortunately, this coincidence was not discovered until later. She passed, and it's been fun getting a description from Rose, who lives in Curtin, as to what questions my father asked and what her answers were. Fisher's actual retirement was marked by a departmental dinner for him, held in Trinity College. I was running a little hand printing press at the time, and printed the menus, which were circulated for signing at the end of the evening. With the first beneath my belt, the opportunity for doing research for a PhD was opened up, and I was advised to apply for a Medical Research Council scholarship for 3 years in the department, which I obtained. I have kept a letter from Fisher, dated the 6th of July 1957, agreeing to act as a referee. Although he formally retired at the end of September, no successor was appointed for a while, and he stayed in Cambridge for a further 18 months, until March 1959, to the great benefit of us research students. Tea in his room continued. One day I asked him why, in herd animals, evolution had not ensured that there were more females than males, and he told me to look for the explanation in his 1930 book, The Genetical Theory of Natural Selection. I'm showing you where one of the two copies that I possess of the first edition, which actually still has its dust jacket. That's very, very rare. It's just rather a boring dust jacket, so not surprisingly, threw them away. At about this time, the Dover paperback second edition of the Genetical Theory was published, and I happened to be standing in the departmental office when the secretary opened the parcel of author's copies in Fisher's presence. When he saw the garish cover, he remarked, looks like a book by Ogden. I don't know how much that will lead to, the references to the past of Ogden. That one is too long ago. Oh, come on. Somebody's heard of Mathematics for a Million by Lance Boston.
Man must measure, being copy-paste
from his kids' book. We've got to be very covered. Looks like a book by Hopkins. There was a general understanding that we students could help ourselves to offerings from the boxes in Fisher's room. Though where this idea came from, I don't know. One day, when I was on hands and knees doing just that, he came in. But rather than reprimanding me, as I feared he would, he said something friendly. I think he was wise enough to know that if you want your work to be remembered, your best agents are young, inquiring students. One of the other research students at the time was Walter Bodmer, to whom I sold a 1927 Austin 7, which I bought for £7.10, for spares for my own 1929 Austin 7. See here, I work at the club, pulling out a cable, which was only just small enough to do. I have to admit that I sold it to him for £15, but in self-defence I can add that when it broke down I had it mended and we remained friends. We used to vie with each other for the privilege of giving Fisher a lift from Storey's Way down to Keynes. One day when I won the competition to take him, he was returning some heavy journal volumes to the centre of town. And after he squeezed into the small seat, I noted these on top of him, so he could hardly see out. I think they might have been volumes of Biometrica, Pearson's journal, to which he was unwilling the department should subscribe, but which was taken by Agriculture. I later found a marginal note in his hand in one of these volumes. My asking was further distinguished by having once ferried J.B.S. Haldane. I bought it for £20. From my brother John, who had given Haldane a lift in it in London. Haldane had been smoking a cigar, and John preserved the ash in the ashtray as a memento, just as Haldane had left it. My PhD work was supposed to be on experimental modification of dominance in the mouse. I was to help continue the experiment started by Fisher and Sarah Holmes at University College London many years previously. But I was much more interested in the statistical analysis of human sexuation data arising from reading statistical methods and from Fisher's encouragement. It had been a characteristic of research in his department that students were expected to investigate a number of topics for their PhDs as being educationally more valuable than concentrating on a single project. So I had no difficulty in changing tack. The first academic talk I gave was on the binomial distribution and its generalization, which of generalizations, with Fisher sitting at the back. Years later, I was to give a seminar in Madison, Wisconsin, in the presence of Sewell Wright, the evolutionary geneticist. And a joint paper also I gave with Luca Cavalli-Sforza, with Haldane in the audience, who submitted a question on paper, which I had preserved. So I can claim to have had Fisher, Wright and Haldane in my audiences, and I suspect I'm the sole survivor who can claim that. Contact with Fisher continued on a daily basis, mostly at tea. He was asked to review A.E. Morant's book, The ABO Blood Groups, Comprehensive Tables and Maps of World Distribution. He passed it on to me to do. He would often walk from Storey's Way to Keynes at lunchtime, and occasionally I would accompany him. One day when the weather was particularly suitable for flying divers, which I was very keen on, I remarked that it was difficult to decide whether to spend the afternoon working or at the diving club, and he immediately advised the diving club. He was very welcoming to visitors to the department. I think he was quite lonely there, both from us point of view of statistical colleagues and biological colleagues. And those of us with new babies to show off were sure of a warm welcome. My first daughter, Anne, was born in May 1959 and was soon introduced to receive the professorial blessing, Fisher cradling her in his arms whilst we were thinking back to his own six daughters. Many years later, after Ernd had qualified as a librarian, I asked her to invigilate and display official books in the Keys Library, which I had prepared for a visiting society, but was unable to attend myself. When she doubted whether she knew enough about Fisher and his work to be able to introduce the display, I pointed out that all she had to say was that Fisher had once held her in his arms. I was only once or twice at Fisher's room in Keys, not in my own college, of course. His set was above the senior combination room, complete with a cupola over the centre of the living room, which you can see if you go into Gondel Court. When I myself became a fellow of Keyes in 1968, I picked up a lot of stories about him, but of course they were not my own reminiscences, and therefore not for recalling now. One of the occasions he invited me over was to introduce me to Frank Gaines, who was visiting him. At Christmas 1958, I discovered that Fisher was staying in college over the holiday. He had just one cook assigned to him to look after him. He was the only fellow left in college. And I thought he might appreciate being offered an evening at home. My wife Catherine and I had invited my father to spend Christmas with us at our cottage in Barton, where we still live, just 3 miles from Keys. Mother had to be admitted to hospital with a chest complaint, and we thought the two men might enjoy each other's company. Father had arrived with a brace of pheasant given him by a grateful patient, but when Catherine came to pluck them, it was clear that one of them was ripe for immediate burial. I collected Fisher from Keys, and we settled down to a rather thin meal, not helped by us having kept the news from Father, who innocently offered Fisher a second helping, which he accepted. Disaster was averted by a preliminary issue of Swedish Akvavit, an absorbing conversation which included a discourse by Fisher on the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Before dinner, he helped me light the sitting room fire, which he insisted could only be done with precisely 5 pages of the Times. That's the proper Times, not the tabloid Times, of course. 5 pages of the tabloid Times wouldn't do. Before I returned to Keys, I asked him to conform to the Swedish habit of signing our guest book, so we have a record of the exact date. When Fisher finally left the department, there were a number of books of indeterminate ownership looking for homes. It must be remembered that the departmental library, and especially its fine Ottoman collection, had evolved out of the personal library of R.C. Punnett, the first Arthur Balfour professor, augmented by Fisher's own material, such as the book by Corrado Gini I've already mentioned. And although the library might now be considered the property of the university, the same was not necessarily true of books elsewhere in the department, which were originally, and probably still, Fisher's property. One of these was his contributions to mathematical statistics, published by Wiley in 1950. There was already a copy in the library, and this one that I found was inscribed to be kept in Dr. Owen's room. Realising that the future direction of the department's interests was not likely to embrace advanced statistical theory, I took it to Fisher and asked him to sign it. He asked me where I'd found it. And when I told him, he thought for a moment, autographed it, and I've used it ever since. After we left for Australia, which is where he retired to, I later took into safekeeping his interleaved copy of the 1953 reprinted 6th edition of The Design of Experiments, which I found lying around. It contained amendments and insertions in his own hand. Years later, on visiting Adelaide and consulting his correspondence, all of which is now on the internet, I was mortified to find a letter from Fisher's former secretary in the Cambridge department saying, no, she could not find the interleaved copy for which she had asked. But I'm placing this copy with the other material from the Fisher Memorial Trust. I don't think that's quite right. But I'm placing this copy with the other material from the Fisher Memorial Trust. Now, the Fisher Memorial Trust has a certain amount of Fisher material. I'm placing this copy with that material, and it will all be housed in the archives of Godwin and King's College. So I sold my conscience in that way. Fisher was, I think, quite lonely and academically isolated at the time, but he lived in King's College and enjoyed the companionship of the other fellows. I've already mentioned that his department was viewed as something of an upstart by botany and zoology, but this is not the occasion to elaborate the general theme, other than by recalling an anecdote of my own, which I've already published. It goes like this. We were sitting on the lawn of Whittingham Lodge, the home of the Cambridge University Department of Genetics, in the early summer of 1957, and Fisher was telling half a dozen of our students about his relations with the university. I am a well-known statistician, he said, and a fairly well-known geneticist, but I've never been consulted on any appointment to a university post in statistics or genetics outside my own department. My three-year MRC scholarship ended in September 1960, and I applied for a Darwin Research Fellowship of the Eugenics Society. Not until many years later did I discover that it was Charles Darwin's fourth son, Leonard, who was being commemorated, and not Charles himself, and that Fisher had been the instigator of these fellowships before the war. There is Leonard. I do not recall whether it was at his suggestion that I applied, but I'm sure he must have been delighted that I succeeded, and may indeed have played his part in ensuring that I did. After Fisher went to live in Adelaide in 1959, I saw him on his visits to Cambridge for the last time in 1961. We were also together at the Second International Conference of Human Genetics in Rome in September that year, and met frequently. One day, Luca Cavalli-Sforza and his wife, Alba, invited us both to lunch at the hotel. As we entered it, I remarked about the word albergo over the door, that I thought it had an H in it. I was learning Italian, with the singular and the plural, of course. Fisher said, perhaps they got their H's in Rome. It's extraordinary how one remembers these single little comments. At the conference, Fisher was much in evidence, no more so than when he walked out of the session on blood groups as soon as A.S. Wiener started to speak. There's no conflict there, which most of you won't know about. On one occasion, he and I were chatting with Peter Parsons, who'd been a Cambridge PhD student with Fisher, and Peter noticed Haldane standing all by himself a little distance away. He suggested to Fisher that we might go across and talk to him, but there was no response. After one session, Fisher told us he was going off to the Vatican to visit the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, to which he'd just been elected, and off he went, walking stick in hand. It is my last memory of him. Quite probably, he'd not warned them of his visit, and I don't know if he gained access. In Cambridge, Fisher spent some of the summer staying in Keys, and the time is remembered as one in which the dining in college, normally thin at that time of the year, gradually expanded as fellows realised that their prized conversationalist was once more among them. I was, of course, not yet of their company, but I did visit Fisher in college so as to discuss a typescript he had written on the St. Petersburg paradox, a paradox in probability. And I discussed it with him sitting in the senior combination room. This has not, so far as I know, been published, but I possess a copy and I consulted an expert on the mathematics of the paradox about it to be advised that it was of interest and not quite correct. My last letter from Fisher, dated the 14th of March 1962, was in reply to one of mine about that paradox. These recollections, as accurate as selective and fallible memory can make them, will stand on their own feet as a record of my personal interaction with Fisher. I cannot judge what impression they make on others, but writing them has refreshed my memory of a man to whom I owe great debt. I never had a crossword from him, and from our first meeting he always seemed interested in my future, probably contributing to it behind my back in ways I shall never know. Having studied mathematical physics himself, perhaps he saw I needed rescuing from it, and that he was in a position to do so. When he saw his rescue bear fruit, and I saw how much I owed him, we became quite attached to each other, in spite of the age difference, as had he and Leonard Darwin. I shall close these reminiscences with an anecdote that reflects this. In a letter to the zoologist R.R. Race, on the 27th of September 1960, Fisher wrote, "The Edwards who messed up Cleghorn's data, and is formally thanked for it in his letters of Nature, seems not to be my Edwards from Cambridge. It was the thought that it was he that annoyed me, for the estimates published in Nature were manifestly incompetent, and I feared that one of my own pupils was running amok and adding unnecessarily to darkness and confusion. However, I understand he is only one of Hogwarts, so all is explained." Hogwarts Edwards was my brother John, who had been influenced by Lancelot Hogman when their careers overlapped at the University of Birmingham. He allowed me to use this quotation, and I have published it previously. John had written one of the first general computer programs for maximum likelihood estimation, and he had helped T. Cleghorn by using it to estimate the frequencies of the four chromosomes of the blood group system, MMS. I think a little bit of blackboard work might help here. I don't get that practice of blackboard these days. Cleghorn's data came from the English blood group donors. Unfortunately, neither John nor Cleghorn had noticed that when all four antisera are used, all nine genotypes are identifiable. So what are the nine genotypes? I started with the top one, right? I've forgotten my lecture abilities. Anyway, the nine genotypes are So we've got nine genotypes. Unfortunately, neither John nor Cleghorn have noticed that when all four antisera are used, all nine genotypes are identifiable. So the numbers of the genes for M lockers and N lockers, for N lockers and S lockers, can be actually counted. Consequently, the maximum likelihood estimates of the four chromosome frequencies are necessarily constrained to maximally observed gene proportions. Only the double heterozygotes S are of uncertain phase, but there are either M, S, M, little S, or they are M, little S, M, big S. Got them all? Only the double heterozygotes, M, N, S, little S, are of uncertain phase, and there they are. That's why maximum likelihood estimation is needed at all. Fisher had immediately spotted that John's estimates for the chromosomes did not correspond to the gene counts. Naturally, with sufficient iterations of his program, if written correctly, his program should have converged to them, and I could only suppose that it did not do enough iterations or perhaps did not iterate at all. But his was a pioneering application of computers to estimating gene frequencies. And after 50 years, I must now say after 54 years, the error should only be remembered as having generated a fine example of Bishop of Fisher's barbed style in private correspondence to a close friend. I was writing my first computer programs in genetics at the time, and might easily have fallen into the same trap. But I escaped unscathed, and years later, when John showed me the letter, I was very happy to find that Fisher had claimed me as my Edwards. Well, I should be very happy to continue reminiscing if anybody has any questions or remarks.
Well, before the talk being over, thank you very much.
Might be able to hear your questions, or I might not, depending upon how clearly they're put.
Anthony, I've got lots of questions that come into the category you suggest of things that you might be willing to say once but not put down on paper. The first one starts as an anecdote, but there's a question at the end of it. Quite a long time ago now, the RSS started collecting recordings of senior statisticians, and they started with the obvious senior ones like David Cox and Dennis Lindley and George Farmer. It was too late to get Fisher, he'd already died.
There is, incidentally, if I might interrupt, no known recording of his voice. Because although he gave programming, he spoke on the third program, and things were published from that in the listener. In those days, the BBC wiped the tapes and used them again. I'm sorry.
So as a second best, I said, well, let's compile a set of reminiscences of Fisher by people who knew him. And I was actually there when we did a recording, George Box. And I just said to George, what do you remember about Fisher? And he came up with his story about the war and he being told to go to Fisher. And was he delivering a horse or collecting a horse or something? I won't go into, I'll leave you to tell the story if you'd like. But this was a short recording that was there with the microphones and cameras rolling and things. But as soon as they were switched off, and I was just chatting to George Box, he revealed that Fisher had had a psychiatrist all his life. And I said, I didn't know that. He said, well, no, of course we don't. I don't want that record. Do you know anything at all about that side of him?
Yes, and that I know secondhand about his bad temper. And the fact that he could lose control of his temper quite readily. And I never experienced that. But I did hear George Farmer. I used to talk a lot to George Farmer. And George did say that Fisher had told him that he much regretted his inability to control his temper and that he had lost a number of good friends in that way, which rather fits in with what you're saying.
George's explanation was that Fisher found it absolutely impossible to understand why people didn't understand it.
Well,
he was so much brighter than that.
I've just come to the end of 58 years trying to understand Fisher's fundamental theorem of natural selection. This appears in the 1930 book. And like many people, I've published various sort of misunderstandings of it. But all the time, I continue to be critical of what other people have been saying about it. And indeed, right from the beginning, there was a tendency for people just to write it off as not being worth considering, mainly because they didn't understand it, of course. And you just have to work very, very hard for a very long time at what Fisher's doing. And the reason I've been so obstinate in trying to understand the fundamental theorem is that I had the same experience when trying to understand traditional probability.
Yeah.
And you read all the statements by famous statisticians, but it's complete nonsense, and then you sort of work at it and you worry about it, and slowly you begin to see what Fisher is driving at. And then eventually you get knowledgeable enough about it so that you see that you cannot, with fiducial probability, produce the global theory of statistical estimation which he was looking for. And he realized that in the end, I think. So it's an interesting little subset of the things you can do in statistical inference. But when you study the work of somebody like Fisher so intensely about one subject, then of course, when you turn to another subject, you tend to assume that it's going to be just as difficult and that you must pay just as much attention to every word in the sentences that he writes. No nonsense in his writing about similes or boxed explanations or anything like that. No, you've just got to go down the page, no, sentence at a time. Leonard Darwin once said to him, I advise you, only one new subject in each sentence. You get the feeling that you've really, you must never dismiss what he's saying. You may think it's nonsense to begin with, but for goodness sake, don't tell anybody you think that, because it's not true. You will eventually understand it. And it really has taken me all these years, on and off, to come to a conclusion about the fundamental theorem, which I've just been writing about. I feel satisfied about it now, like I did about thinking about fiducial probability. So whether it's important or not, I don't know. But at least I understand it. I get great satisfaction from that.
A related point, I think it was George Box said of the Statistical Methods for Research Workers that nobody, or that he was advised when he was first becoming a statistician, nobody should read the book who has not already read it. I guess, do you agree with that? And if so, what on earth was your reaction to it when picking it up at the age of 18, not having done any
well,
science
just,
at all?
Well, you learned a bit about the significance, just I didn't worry about the mathematics at all. But George Barnard, when he was very young, he went to Fisher and said, how do I learn some statistics? Because, you know, I'm a good mathematician. I think George was a logician as much as anything. And Fisher simply said to him, prove all the statements in Statistical Methods for Research Workers. Well, one should explain that the book is notorious for having no proofs in it, because
yeah.
Fisher sort of did things in his head and didn't worry too much about how he got there.
Yes, well, in the sense that it is, if you like, intended as a kind of introductory book, it is very difficult for most readers to move from one statement to the next within it.
But you know, I never found that. It's very elementary to begin with.
Yeah.
You know, it takes you about three chapters to get to the binomial distribution.
Yes.
And then that's all spelled out very carefully. And slowly, it's not a very long book. Well, I recommend it anyway.
But on the financial question, it reminds me of Ian Hacking's analysis of the fiducial argument, where he showed that it depended on assuming what he calls a principle of irrelevance. That the fiducial probability is only valid if you can make that assumption about the situation you're applying to.
That was an extremely important insight of Ian Hacking's, insight, and he got it from Howard Jeffries.
Uh-huh.
And that brings us to the question, what were the relations between Fisher and Howard Jeffries?
Yeah.
The evidence I have is that they were very good, that they both respected each other's position on statistical inference, and the correspondence which has been published really bears this out. Howard Jeffries once took me to a feast in St. John's, so I quizzed him a lot about his relations with Fisher, of course. I can tell you less about Fisher's relations with Haldane, but I have read everything that they said about each other, and they were quite good too. But two people.
I saw David at loggerheads.
Pardon?
I saw David at loggerheads, Haldane and Fisher didn't like each other.
I didn't say they liked each other. And of course they had quite different political views.
Yes.
So on subjects like communism and Lysenko and the Daily Worker and so forth, they were poles apart.
I'm not so bad.
But in the 1930s, they both served on a very important committee in London set up by the Medical Research Council to consider what was to be done about human genetics. And at that time, when Fisher was the editor of the Annals of Eugenics, he was publishing a lot of Haldane's stuff in it. So the real antagonism was with Lancelot Hogburn. I don't think he argued with Hogburn much, he just thought he was an old silly. He argued on the statistical side with Jerzy Neyman, and he argued with, on the evolutionary biology side, with Sewell Wright. And there's no doubt about those arguments. I've spoken to people who knew both men quite well. But when it came to his Cambridge contemporaries, Haldane and Jeffreys, I think he had a very good sense of how important they were, how important their work was, and that has stood the test of time too.
But wasn't it Jeffreys that he said, my own approach has been more pedestrian? And some insight to do with Bayes' theorem or... Fisher said, my own approach has been more pedestrian.
No, that was Fisher.
Yes, Fisher said that, but he said it was Jeffreys who he was crediting with being the less pedestrian than himself.
No, Fisher was the editor of the Annals of Eugenics. Jeffreys had written a paper about inference, which Fisher had published in the Annals of Eugenics. And he added this little bit at the bottom, saying things about Jeffreys' paper, and adding that his own position had been rather more pedestrian, and that perhaps he should have taken the notion of likelihood as the primitive postulate, I think is the phrase. Well, I agree with that, of course, having written a book on likelihood.
Yeah.
A little bit about his relationship with Sewell Wright, especially with regards to adaptive landscapes.
Didn't catch that, I'm afraid.
With Sewell Wright and their difference of opinion on adaptive landscapes.
Somebody will have to translate it for me.
Adaptive landscapes, Sewell Wright.
On Sewell Wright, yes.
And
adaptive landscapes.
They're called now adaptive landscapes. Wright's landscape.
I'm not catching you at all, I'm afraid. I better go as far as Sewell Wright. Somebody help me.
The other phrase was adaptive landscape.
Oh, what about adaptive landscapes? Yes.
Yeah, and sort of the difference in opinion.
Well, I could tell you more about that than you would have time to listen to. the difference between the fundamental theorem and adaptive landscapes was not appreciated for a very long time. The difference one can now see is merely outlined by Fisher as early as 1932, which is when Sewell Wright produced the notion of an adaptive landscape. This is an evolutionary surface that populations are supposed to be climbing up as they get better and better adapted. And the fundamental difference is that Fisher was talking about a way of looking at natural selection which was inductive. It was as though he was analysing an agricultural experiment, which of course he was doing at the time at Walthamstow anyway, when he wrote about when he wrote the genetical theory of natural selection. So Fisher is doing an analysis of variants of the forces that are involved in the theory of natural selection, taking a single point in time, as you would with a field experiment, and analysing what the effects were. And he said right from the beginning that Sewell Wright's approach is wrong because it's mechanistic. It is as though you are trying to do biology the way that physicists look at the course of a comet, as though there's a field of force. As it's turned out, of course, Wright's mathematics, as he in the end appreciates himself, doesn't correspond to any sort of field of force way of looking at biology. Though many people follow it these days, I mean, there's a lot of it going on in the literature at the moment. And the important thing is that Fisher is making an inductive statement about the workings of evolution. Sewell Wright, and to an extent Haldane at the time, were trying to create a mechanistic model of evolution as to how gene frequencies change, so that you could predict what was going to happen next on the basis of this model. And Fisher says, no, that's much too difficult. Everything's changing all the time. The best we can do is to take a particular moment in evolution, look at the data we've got of how things are changing, and try and analyze how much of it is due to changing gene frequencies, for example. Was that anything like the question you asked?
Yeah, and so I know too, he wrote a letter to Ford a while back talking about a single peak landscape. Did he support that view?
Didn't catch it up.
Sorry, a single peak landscape, he wrote to Ford about it.
Didn't I write about it?
Fisher wrote to Ford and said about
a single peak landscape
Fisher?
Versus Wright's rugged landscape.
Fisher, I think, only really got around to saying anything about adaptive landscapes in his 1941 paper, where he's trying to explain more fully what he was doing in advancing his his fundamental theorem of natural selection in 1930. And it's there that he points out the difference between his approach and Wright's approach. And he's very critical mathematically of Wright's approach too. So he's critical biologically because he doesn't think that anybody is going to analyze evolutionary changes caused by changing gene frequencies in the way that Wright is doing it. But he's also critical fundamentally mathematically. And he was indeed a better mathematician than Wright was. So yes, they thought about that. Wright is one of the many people who never actually understood the fundamental theorem of natural selection. But I should qualify that to be fair to him. Sometimes in his writings he does say something sensible about it, but then he backslides. He's been talking to other people also and he's got into a muddle again. So he never had some consistent view of the fundamental theorem.
Talking of mathematics, did he actually prove his little theorem in combinatorics about partial block designs, or just found out that it's always the case? I'm sure you know his little theorem in combinatorics about partial block designs.
No, I don't. I know of it. There's lots of people here who do know about it.
No, but. No point.
There are in all sorts of different fields Fisher's theorems, which many of us who do Fisher just don't know about because we don't interest ourselves in those particular fields. The fundamental theorem has been difficult to get straight, even though the mathematics is extremely simple when you finally get it sorted out. One of the characteristics which Fisher had, I have been told, is that if you asked him to explain something which was in one of his works, which people did find difficult to explain, he didn't like to go back to it. He wasn't confident that he knew how he'd got the result. So he really wanted to pass you on to somebody else to explain it, or tell you to go and read his book or something like that. He wouldn't sit down with him.
I read a claim in, I think it's an Encyclopedia of Biological Statistics, as a little biography of Fisher.
Forwarded by me.
And possibly, don't think so, but anyway, said that towards the end of his life, he, as you said, was in demand as a dinner dining companion, had good relations with his students worldwide, and avoided the mistakes that he had made in his early relationships.
So whether he learned something from the psychiatrist or whether just got wiser with age, I don't know. But was that borne out by your experience that he was sort of getting it right socially or?
He was very good with our students, in my experience. And I mean, I've already mentioned people like Walter Bodmer and Peter Parsons, and there were three or four or five of us. And he was very good with us. But there's no doubt that he was very lonely academically. He was lonely on the statistical side because of the dominance of the American statistical school led by Josie Naiman, which had taken over the textbooks and everything. So Fisher on the statistical side, I hope you'll bear me out on this, but I think Fisher on the statistical side was simply regarded as a very interesting person from the past, but we've moved on from that now. Certainly that's the view I got from talking to George Barnard as much as I did. And on the genetical side, nobody had understood his great book, The Genetical Theory of Natural Selection. Now that book is now in the ascendant, largely through the work of Richard Dawkins, actually, because you know one sees that the work that Fisher did at that time is a description of how we should look at things from the point of view of the gene. And that is precisely what the fundamental theorem is doing. And it's coping with the fact that in diploid organisms like man, it's very confusing because they're diploid. It would be much better if we were all haploid. We'd get on with our science much more easily. But perhaps we couldn't be quite such clever scientists. So on both sides, Fisher was lonely. It's as simple as that. So, you know, an undergraduate from Trinity Hall knocks on the door one summer's afternoon. Well, he's got someone to talk to.
But he didn't then lose his temper. No.
I think with all us young people, he never lost his temper. I mean, it was with people like my tutor Charles Crawley who lost his temper. He would have gone round there with his walking stick and he would have banged on the door and, you know, said terrible things which reverberated round Trinity Hall so that I could pick up the echoes 20 years later. It was very lonely in the family too because, well, he was in Keynes alone at Christmas time. Oh, how did that happen?
I'm going to risk another one. This problem with the reception of the fundamental theorem, of Fisher's fundamental theorem of natural selection, I don't claim to understand it thoroughly, but the basic idea that a population with more heritable variation in it is going to move more when natural selection acts on it,
yes,
than
sure.
A population without, surely, if anyone can see that, everyone can see that, everyone can see that, no?
That was what people, including Fisher, were saying in the 1920s, and come 1930, and he does it mathematically. I am nearly all mathematicians here. I think I can do this, I won't attempt to do it on the board, but let me do the basis of the fundamental theorem in plain English. Leaving out the genetics completely, what does it actually rely on? It relies on a simple theorem which I have christened many years ago, the growth rate theorem. If you have a number of different sectors, they might be economic sectors, they might be populations, anything that's growing in size, in numbers, then what the theorem says is that if those growth rates, if the growth rates of those sectors are constant, or different of course, but if they're constant in each sector, it says that the rate of change of the mean growth rate of them all together is equal to the variance in the growth rates. Now it's a lovely theorem. The mathematicians at the back who are listening should have got it down in maths by now because it's very, very easy. Go, you know, prove it before you go to bed. You have different sectors growing at different rates, constant rates, so they're growing exponentially. You can prove it in continuous time or discrete time, it doesn't matter which. Well, I think there's a constant involved in discrete time. These sectors are growing, obviously. The ones that are growing faster are going to dominate in the end until finally the one that has the highest growth rate is going to occupy the whole space. What Fisher is relying on is what nobody had bothered to prove before, and with typical Fisher, he doesn't actually prove it himself. He uses a variant of that, an extension of that, to prove the fundamental theorem, to cope with the haploid-diploid problem. But the rate of the mean rate of growth is simply proportional to the variance in growth rates, as you might expect. Prove it. Not looking worried.
What you mean by variance in growth rate? I mean, if one understands the term, then this must be a triviality. I mean, that's it.
Well, this is a related point. Supposing they are all growing at equal rates,
yes.
The variance of growth rate is zero.
Yeah, so everything stays the same.
But they grow.
Oh, well, you can normalize it. I mean, you can say the total population is stable or something like that. But, yeah, okay.
The mean growth rate doesn't change.
The mean growth rate
doesn't change at all.
It doesn't change.
Okay.
The theorem says it doesn't change. Thank you.
It took me the whole of Christmas 2014 to prove that. Certainly.
Nick has thought about it quite a lot, actually. I've got something for you, Nick. This paper, it's out of the commentary. It says, analyzing nature's experiment, Fisher's inductive theorem of natural selection. You don't really need to read it, you just have to notice the title. It's an analysis of nature's experiment. I don't think that's been appreciated before. One's thinking of a population of genotypes which are increasing at different rates, but the total population size is staying the same.
Ah.
So, you know, there's a constant involved.
So there's a box of finite size.
And for advanced workers, what it means is that if you have a diploid population, then your growth rates for the different genotypes may demonstrate that there's dominance, and it takes out the dominance effect and leaves you with the effect that determines, so says Fisher, the rate of change of the gene frequencies. So, well, if you don't understand that, if you're a geneticist, you'll understand it, and if you're not, you don't. But it's a very nice little theorem. I've been selling it to economists a long time now. I mean, it's just basic theorem of economics.
Was there anyone in Fisher's family who followed his academic career later?
No. He had
six daughters,
and a baby who died in... because one of her sisters fed her pebbles on the beach, and that was the end of that. And he had two sons. George was killed in the RAF during the war, and he was evidently the brighter of the two. Harry did manage to get a Cambridge degree through Gombe and King's College, and I knew him quite well. He died a few years ago at the age of about 85. I think he must have worked at Rothamsted. He was a chemist of some kind. So he had a perfectly normal career. He was very like his father in some ways. He told me once that when he was an undergraduate in Caen, Fisher had been asked to talk about eugenics, which he did. And there was a very crowded meeting, undergraduates going to hear what Fisher had to say. And when Harry got to the room, there was no room to sit down, so he stood at the back. And he listened to his father, and Harry said to me, and there I was, standing at the back, proving him wrong all the time. The children, the two I know, or the daughters, the two I have met them all except one who died young in Australia. The five I know, come to think of it, one of them, Rose Newsome, general practitioner from Bar Hill. Anybody had her as a doctor? No. She lives in Coton with her husband. Another one is the author of the wonderful biography of Fisher, Joan Box. You've heard of George Box, who was her husband. Joan Box is still alive, lives in Madison, Wisconsin, and I correspond with her quite frequently. And of the others, I've met them only socially. Come to think of it, Elizabeth Cox, I do know what happened to her. She married a doctor and they went out to East Africa as missionaries. And they spent a long time in East Africa, so there are stories from that. One of them, June, married Mr. Posey, but then she unmarried Mr. Posey, and I don't know the family circumstances there. And that's about the lot. I must have forgotten one of them, but anyway, I've told you all I immediately remember. So it's through the existence of the Fisher Memorial Trust that the family's been kept in touch with academics, and that's largely through the efforts of Sir Walter Bodmer, who has been the chairman of the Trust for a long time, but also because the sequence of Fisher Memorial Lectures, which have taken place now since about 1964-65, has been a very, very fine sequence. Now often if you look in copies of the report or something like that, you will see about Eddington Memorial Lectures or Memorial Lectures for this, that and the other person. But they always die away in the end. There are very few of them that keep going. But these Fisher Memorial Lectures, we're all about number 30 now. And they really have been a wonderful set. Starting off with Fisher's colleagues describing his work at first hand, and gradually working through problems that Fisher was interested in, and to some extent the problems that Fisher left us. There was a very good one given in Oxford just recently.
What was the origin of his animus against Lancelot Hogmer? Because I grew up on Man Must Measure, this sort of golden treasury type book. I loved it, you know. I'm rather sad that he...
Lancelot Hogmer wrote a big book in 1957 called Statistical Theory, or something like that. And he was vehemently opposed to much of Fisher's statistical theory on quite well-informed grounds, but he went over the top. He was also rather on the wrong side politically, so Fisher just had no high opinion of him at all. Other people did. He was quite well known in completely other fields. Had a most interesting life. And he was in Oslo when the Germans invaded. And he was with his daughter in Oslo giving some lectures, where they managed to escape to Sweden. And they holed up in Uppsala with the geneticist Gunnar Dahlberg. No clothes, no money, no way of getting out, no, completely stuck. So Dahlberg, who was a very talented person, he learned enough Swedish to be able to translate Gunnar Dahlberg's book, Art of Race, that's Heredity and Race, which Dahlberg had written in Uppsala in 1940, which was a very brave thing to do, because it was, of course, an anti-Nazi book about what the inheritance of different racial characteristics actually did mean and what it didn't mean. And Lancelot Hogmer translated that into a book called Race, Reason and Rubbish, typical sort of mathematics of a million type
alliteration.
So that he could make enough money to think, so where do we go now? And he actually managed to extricate himself by travelling all the way across Russia in the war, and then he got himself across the Pacific. I forget whether this was with his daughter or not, but anyway, he got himself across the Pacific and took an academic job in San Francisco, I think. Finally turned up back in Aberdeen. He had at that time been professor of zoology in Aberdeen. Finally turned up in Aberdeen, where they said, "Where have you been?" And I think he had some difficulty getting some salary out of them. Now these Hogmer Haldane, Sewell Wright, Neyman, Fisher, Days were really very exciting. A lot of animosity, and very firm opinions taken, some of them, most of them correct, not all of them. And the World Statistical Society, I mean, after all, we are a statistical group here. It was wonderful to go down to the World Statistical Society and hear these people like Cox and Bindley and Barnard and so forth. Really first-class academic discussion and disagreement. Very educative.
And indeed, in those days, it was genuine discussion.
Genuine discussion and very educative, yes. Yeah. And comprehensible, too.
So Fishery was not only a statistician and geneticist, but also a geneticist. And I'm wondering what were the controversies in the 50s and 60s about eugenics. I'm not sure about the pronunciation of this word, eugenics.
Eugenics.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So in the 50s or in the 60s, when you were studying in Cambridge, what were the controversies about the eugenics?
In the 50s and 60s, nobody was saying anything, really.
What? So, wasn't it really racist?
Did I get the question wrong?
After World War II, wasn't that already quite racist?
Was not eugenics considered racist? By the 1950s and 60s, yes. Eugenics was surely considered racist in Cambridge.
Oh, that's so American eugenics. No, British eugenics, you have to distinguish between them. They're really quite different. Eugenics in this country started off as an attempt to do human genetics. The Galton Laboratory was set up as a laboratory, believed or not, of practical eugenics. But what they were really on about was trying to support human genetics. So the opinions which came from people like Raymond Pearl and the others in the United States were not mirrored here. But of course, after the war, there was a realization on both sides of the Atlantic that terrible things had been happening. So a big reaction against eugenics, but it was very much the American eugenics which had gone beyond trying to look at human genetics. The people who were influential in the eugenic society before the war were basically, many of them were doctors. They were people who were looking at the implications for human populations of what was then the fairly newly discovered Mendelian mechanism. You really have to look at it as something as earth-shattering as Watson and Crick. Suddenly, we Homo sapiens discovers the genetic basis of our differences. By reading Mendel, we learn that we are like all the other diploid animals in the way things work. So naturally, people ask themselves, good grief, what are the implications of this? So they spent that time trying to work out what the implications were. And they didn't, in this country, leap immediately to the conclusions which were prevalent in the United States. So there are quite big differences there. And goodness knows, I'm no authority on what actually was being discussed in Germany at the time. I know a little bit about the Swedish situation, and that was a bit more extreme. But these histories are very well documented now. People have done good scholarly work on them. Yep. Shall we go now?
If you wish, yes. Have you had enough of us?
You've had enough of me, I should say.
Thank you again very much indeed.